My name is Claire Press, and this is Wardrobe Crisis, the podcast that unzips fashion's issues. Are we starting?
We are seeing a kind of almost Zoolander-esque caricature of how excessive fashion can be.
Our look shifting was like 16 to 20 hours a day. I would work like 450 hours in a month and making only $6.
Creativity is one of the most powerful things that humans have.
We underestimate the power of beauty and the power of humor. These are qualities that connect people, and connectivity is a really potent thing right now.
Don't point a finger, impart knowledge and information instead.
Plus size modeling can go suck it.
It's our job as designers to explore and discover beauty everywhere.
So your voice is crucial and powerful in the supply chain.
Join me every week as we talk ethics, sustainability, and the business and madness of fashion. From who made your clothes, to how they impact on the environment, to the politics of personal style. We are so hot right now.
It's getting hot. My parents feel that this is a waste of time. I tell them go away, cause everything is just fine.
Well, wow. This is the 10th episode of the Wardrobe Crisis podcast. Can you believe it? I almost can't. We've talked about some big, ugly stuff, from ocean plastics to the Rana Plaza factory disaster. So I thought it was about time that we talked about beauty. And I don't mean the beauty myth. I'm talking about the pursuit of beauty, however it is that you want to define it. That is one of the major motivators for lots of people who work in fashion. They want to create beautiful things. That's what drives them, whether it's a beautiful garment or a show or a picture or a magazine cover. Or as the stylist Megan Morton, who we meet in this episode, puts it, they want to capture beauty. They want to chase it and pin it down. Segue alert. Like beauty, a stylist can be hard to pin down because what is it exactly that they do? They're kind of mysterious creatures. Like, how do they make the pictures that they make? How do they weave that weird magic that makes us want to buy something or transports us through the pages of a magazine? I've just been reading a book about this. It's Rizzoli and it's called Stylist. And it looks at the work of people like Grace Coddington and Edward Enifel. And there's an intro by Anna Wintour. And this is a quote from her. A fashion editor's visual perspective is governed by his or her earliest years. Well, Megan Morton grew up on a banana farm in Queensland. That is actually true. And on that farm, her mother was an avid reader of a 1970s Back to the Land magazine called Grassroots. I love this. I'd never actually heard of it, and I Googled it and found the cover, or a cover from an issue from the late 70s. And it looks absolutely fantastic, but I've never seen inside one. But it's all about how to milk your own goat, how to weave your own carpet. I don't know, the best ways to make stew from veggies from your garden. It's all good stuff. If anyone has access to a Grassroots magazine, please, please drop me a line via my website, which is clairepress.com. Now, Megan isn't technically a fashion stylist. Her work is focused on houses and interiors, but I would argue that the approach is the same. She's worked for magazines like Vogue Living and Elle Decoration, and she's the author of 4 books. My goodness, 4 is a lot. The latest is called It's Beautiful Here, and it's published by Thames and Hudson. And you can find out more on Megan's website, which is meganmorton.com. I would urge you to check her out on Instagram, because she's obviously awesome on that medium. And you can find her at Megan_Morton. I've known her for many years, and whenever I see her, she opens my eyes to a visual detail I'd never considered. So that is why I wanted to invite her on the show and share some of that weirdness and wonder with you. I dig how her brain works, and I love listening to her explain the world as she sees it. In this episode, we decode all that. We go off on a lot of beautiful tangents. Megan actually also runs an outfit called The School, which is in Sydney, but it does travel. And they hold these incredible classes on things like shibori dyeing and knitting with giant needles. But we also talk about sustainability in the interiors world. And this was not something I knew very much about. So I was really keen to grill Megan about this and ask her, just how often do conversations about sustainability and the ethics of production come up when it comes to homewares, interiors, and architecture? Ta-da! Megan Morton, I'm delighted to be in this room with you, with your swingy cherry earrings, wearing a cherry red sweater, and just fundamentally being delightful.
I'm so happy to be here, and I just need you to know that there is no bangle clash. I have come to you bangle-less, knowing that we are in a fully very professional soundproof situation.
Because you're a hand talker.
I'm like an Italian nonna. I go up and down and round and I do all my navigation points, and you can't do that on radio with your bangle action.
Love
especially
it.
Not your double.
Love it. We're going to start in a weird way, which I love, because I don't want these interviews to follow a formula. And I thought that since I'm with you, unconventional and fabulous you, that I would throw some quotes your way and ask you to Meganize them.
Let's do it. Like a magic Meganizing machine. Yes.
Let's start with Yves Saint Laurent, because we can. This is one of my favorite quotes from him. Fashions fade, style is eternal.
But every day you have to get up and try again and again. And that's the whole point about fashion turning into style. Every day you get a chance to right your wrongs.
Mm.
Every day you get the choice not to wear a leotard. Leggings. Every day you get the chance to say, today I'm going to go out in the world and be like this. That's what I love about it. So I always think of my view on fashion is purely as an enthusiast. I'm a clothes enthusiast. I know nothing about fashion historically. I know nothing about it technically. But I know that it makes people feel really good, just like a good mantelpiece does, just like a good living room does, just like a good bedside table does. And so really, it falls under the applied arts world.
Mm.
Which is all the fashion I'm interested in, also falls under that category.
But what about that idea of trends? Because I guess that's sort of built into that quote that fashion is kind of based on the idea of in today, out tomorrow, and
well,
fads.
Well, trends are fine if you're a 6 foot tall Ukraine model with no boobs and no hips, but dressing and actually really being in your clothes. You know, there's clothes I always view to get your photo taken in, and there's clothes to move in. And when you understand the difference, you'll totally dress differently. You know, clothes that you want to have your photo taken in, or clothes that you think, oh, I'd so love to have that because it'd be so wonderful to have that in my Megan Morton archive of ridiculous clothes that I should not be wearing, but I should.
I've got them that just bought down on the wall.
Because I just can have them as curtains. But then there's clothes that when you see yourself move in them, and it's also why when I sometimes see celebrities walking in clothes and I think, oh, you are so right, the styling is heaven, but the you in them is not right because it's not how you know. So you've got to really understand, I think, not just your body when you're dressing, but how you are and your expressions and then that can help. You know, moving in clothes is I think, the key to really dressing. Standing still and sitting in a chair is one thing, but, you know, being in them, and which is why I love voluminous, anything with volume, anything that sounds like
you could run
Russell.
Through a field.
Yeah, because I love the 3D-ness of it. When I used to wear brogues all the time, I had really a big thing about Italian brogues, sort of that play on menswear shoes without looking too Andermullermeister. I used to get little bells and I'd change my shoelaces just because I thought, oh, how could I feminize them a little bit, you know, a little bit of embellishment. And then I found an Indian necklace and then I, you know, deconstructed it and added those to my shoelaces. And I thought, oh, my God, I love that.
People
I can hear myself
you coming.
In the smallest of ways, you know, not big, big, loud bells. And I just think, that's it. Like, to move in clothes and to be one with clothes is the real joy of dressing. Because I know so many people have the most incredible wardrobes, but it's all like when they put their incredible dress suit on and they don't love to be in them during the day. And I think, what a waste. What a waste of a wardrobe. Yes.
Yeah.
Like people who have their china only for Christmas lunch.
People
when
who
no
wrap
one's...
their sofas, leave their sofas wrapped in the plastic. Does that even happen,
it's
or is
that
a myth?
Thing.
Have
it's
you
a
seen
myth,
it?
But it does happen metaphorically. There's like an invisibleness around those things. And I think, you know, really loving clothes, just like loving a painter, you want to see your painting all the time. You want to wear your clothes all the time because you want to keep them good. I mean, I often go, oh my God, I really need to look after my clothes, not just in a dry cleaning, maintenance way. But I make sure they're all hanging the right way so they're all in the spoon. You know, I want them to actually feel good because I expect a lot out of them. I need them to be ready when I'm ready. So I often, you know, one of my life's goals when I was younger, when I first moved to Sydney, was that I wanted to have all of my clothes on wooden coat hangers until I realized that you could get 10 items in on a wire hanger for as much space as you could with wooden. And then it was at the time when I was really into vintage, not because I understood it, but because it was all I could afford. So me going to charity stores and finding beautiful cardigans with sequins, and I just rechanged the buttons. I just couldn't do the mother of pearl button, but I just refreshed the buttons. Or sometimes I'd find immaculate cashmere cardies and I'd take them to my Vietnamese dressmaker and get her to stitch in moth holes. Like we'd actually stitch a repair in.
Yeah.
So it looked a little bit, you know, not too plush secretary.
Oh, hang on a minute. You'd stitch in fake moth holes.
Yes, fake moth holes. Well, no, I'd do an overstitch, like a Japanese, you know, a Japanese stitch. So it looked like there was a repair on it because I just thought, oh, I have to just muddle this down a little bit because I used to find the most incredible things.
But you liked the aesthetics of repaired.
Yeah, I did. And just adding something of yourself into it. And so, which is why I loved accessories, you know, no matter what size I've worn through 3 pregnancies, through working in the city corporately, through to being a freelancer, I've just loved the add-ons. You know, for me, the add-ons are where I begin dressing.
I could talk about add-ons because I've got a whole upcycling question that I want to throw at you, but I'm back to my quotes, Megan.
Yes, let's do that. Mr. Dior.
Mr. Dior. So this was hard to find because loads of his quotes are just about women being flowers, which just sounds absolutely ridiculous in 2017.
But so the shape, I think, you know, I see very much floral in his shapes and his approach.
Well, all that Dior New Look stuff was about women being flowers.
Totally.
But I feel like that sounds ever so...
I know, but I think he was just saying more nature.
Yeah, so the quote is about nature. So it is, you can never really go wrong if you take nature as an example.
Well, I'd like to one-up that. No, you know, no disrespect to Mr. Dior. And say you can never really go wrong if you take wallpaper and fabric as an example. If you look at beautiful wallpaper and fabric design, chinoiserie through to, you know, Lee Joffa through to anything that you
through
can
to
find.
What?
Lee Joffa. Lee Joffa is a very beautiful textile designer. Upholstery fabrics and silk satin cushions and taffeta of, you know, he's kind of like the Christian Dior really of interior fabrics. You see such perfect examples of colour, proportion, balance, shape, scale in interior fabric. Sometimes I think, oh my God, I do look like a couch, a chintzy couch. And a month ago, my son was walking with me in one of my big skirts and we were coming towards traffic and some of his age group people yelled out, oh my God, where are your curtains? Your mum's wearing your curtains. And I said, darling, I'm so, so sorry. And he said, Mum, please, like, you know, come on, we're just going to the shops. And I said, darling, it's really important because you watch every old person we walk past will give me a smile, as in, thank you so much for wearing that big bally skirt. But it's very true. I think sometimes curtain fabrics and old vintage textiles, they're the cues to take. I often look for vintage fabrics and I take them to my sewer and get them made in Dior style, as in very simple cinched waist, zip at the back to pockets.
Always pockets.
Always pockets. Always.
I was going to say there's a picture of you which I really love where you've got a trench coat on and you've fabriced or fashioned a belt for it out of a strip of old curtain fabric.
Oh, yes, I love any sort of trim like that. I basically stole that from my love of Dries Van Noten and the way he does that so well. Half the time his belts look like tassels of a curtain and it's not from Versailles, and that's the lovely trick of genre and style that he plays with so impactfully. But I love getting curtain trim or bullion or fringing and using it as my little bit, because whatever the belt came in is the least important part of the outfit, right? Because they're just doing cost efficiencies on the belt. No one's ever going to give you, unless you dress one on, no one's ever going to give you the really amazing belt. So I think, oh, it's such a lovely shape or such a lovely color, I will just rebelt it myself.
Is it about being upcycling woman? Because I always look at everything through that lens. So I'm like, oh, you may do with something.
Yeah.
But is it that or more luxurious for you?
No, for me, it's just about having my own version of events. You know, I love the idea that I can pull from different genres and different styles. And then the way I mix them together is with belts. Endpoints, really, for me, it's shoes, cocktail rings, bangles and belts, because everything else can go up and down, can't it?
Mm-hmm.
You can go high, you can go low, you can go recycled, you can go new. And I feel really efficient when I use the things that I've loved for many, many years. When I get out my, you know, I've got some really fantastic Ferragamo scarves that are very sort of early 40s and really, really, really masterful in the silk edging and the color palette. And I just think, who wouldn't want to wear that as a top? And when I wear it as a top, I actually think, how wonderful.
What, like tied around as a bikini?
I tie it up here and then I tie it at the back.
Like a halter.
And then I put a blazer over the top and I'll put it with some really lovely, big, wide leg Bottega Veneta pants or something that I've had from the 80s. And I just think it's as heavenly as a beautiful painting.
On a side note, I thought I would just raise something I heard the other day, which is Ferragamo has just debuted the first luxury use or commercial use of orange fibre.
How heaven.
Yeah, so it was they were prize winners.
That's
I read
amazing.
About them in Italian Vogue a couple of years ago, and they're actually in my book. But they're basically using fibre that's been made from discarded citrus fruits.
How heaven.
Yeah, fab.
Sensory.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I want it.
I have another quote.
Yes.
This one is from Diana Vreeland.
Yes.
I could basically do an entire podcast discussing DV quotes. In fact, I might. But for now, this is probably my favorite. Give ideas away. Under every idea, there's a new idea waiting to be born.
It's so true. I mean, I live my life by that.
But it's tough. That's tough. We were talking about this before.
Well, it's almost like the person at school who doesn't want to show the work. And out of school, that's what life is like, isn't it? There are people who are very, very secluded and won't tell you their tricks or their special people. But I learned very early on that if I didn't give my best upholsterer, and not my second best, but my truly best upholsterer, to you or anyone else who wanted his details, he'd be out of business. And so I think that gave me that idea that being flush and doing well affects everybody in your circle. And the only way to continue to do that is to give everything you know.
Mm. And also there's not a limited amount of success in the world by sharing success and by being generous with your contacts and your knowledge.
Only really clever people will give it away because no one's threatened. And that's, you know, very much how we do it at the school. If anyone is a little bit shady on details, how do you really make the amazing soap set, or how do you really do the screen printing in those colours? That for me is a test of who we get to teach class at the school. And that's what I like to do. If someone says, how did you do that picture? I will tell them everything, the conditions, the budget, what we got paid for it, what we didn't get paid for it, what happened at the end, and how commercially really successful it was, as opposed to how commercially successful it looked like on Instagram, and all those kind of amazing things. And so I think the more you can give away, the more free you are, because when you hang on to anything, a concept that you think you've owned or that you think that you've been part of giving birth to, it stops you then from keeping ahead. And the only way is forward.
I feel like really excited, like jumping in and out of my chair when we're having this conversation, because in the ethical fashion space, sharing is so important. Like, we need to be open with our contacts about how to shake up our supply chains.
Totally.
Or how to share the best makers.
And how we can keep every single person, big or small, in our tight little family, because we're all going for the same thing.
But people are obviously circumspect about sharing commercially valuable information. You know, I get it as well. Like, I'm maybe sometimes that person that you just mentioned at school going, don't look at my work. So you kind of fight with that. Like, you know that it's right to be generous of spirit, and that if what you put out comes back to you in the world. But also sometimes you're just freaked out that people are going to steal all your thunder.
Have you ever seen a woman? I mean, I speak very much from the interior space, but it's the same woman, because her interior is the same as her wardrobe. Someone who doesn't want to tell you
The one who
anything.
Taps the nose.
Yes.
For me to know.
Oh, I don't know where this is from. I forget. Or I'm not really sure. And I think when you are like that, you don't enjoy it. And the whole thing for me is chasing beauty. And the only way you can chase beauty is to have everyone on your beauty chasing train. So if you're with people who are lacking in that spirit, it's not even that, it's just a miseducation, I think. I was brought up to love everything and everyone and see wonder where there was no wonder. And I really think that's such a valuable asset for anybody working in, you know, any kind of art direction or aesthetic driven disciplined world, because when you only want beauty, you will find it every day. And you will not care, and you'll just bulldoze through. And whatever happened yesterday, you get to wake up and have the next chance at it. And then it becomes this really beautiful, self-satisfying thing that no one can take away from you. And then you don't feel like you need to hide your work. You just want everyone to have the same access. So you'll say, oh, the Charing Cross St. Vinny's is a treasure trove for Kashmir, not because I've just got every good piece out of it, because there's only so much Kashmir one person can have. Yeah. And there's only so much beautiful embellished belts or sari trimmed, whatever, that anybody can have. The idea is that there's such abundance. And when you're abundant, you will just keep the abundant cycle going.
Love. Love that. The next one, and there are five, yes. This is number four. The next one is from Coco Chanel, and it kills me because I basically do the opposite. Mm. It's about maximalism versus yes. minimalism or classic elegance. And the quote is, before you leave the house, look in the mirror and take at least one thing off.
I think it's a great starting point. What I do is I like that tiny bit of vulgar. I like to play with what is beautiful and what is not, and what is vulgar and what is not. And so sometimes I'll think, okay, well, that looks great. Tick, 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 feeling good. I'm in on time. And I'll just want to do something that's a little bit mushy. You know, mushy? Like, and so I'll...
What's mushy? Well, I think mushy that means squashed.
Like when I pick my outfit, and I plan outfits like months in advance, not because I'm vain and need to look the best all the time. It's the total opposite. I'm just really time poor. I am renovating my house. I have three kids, and I don't want to be that person who makes everybody late. That's one thing I hate. You know, being late for an outfit is so ridiculous. So I know a month in advance what I'm wearing, what needs to go to the dry cleaner, what needs to be rehealed, if those colors are right, because I love to custom dye things. I like to find something, and, you know, eBay, Etsy time can take about 3 weeks to get here. And if I've found a lobster clutch made out of raffia, I definitely want that.
One shaped like a lobster. Yes. Have you found that?
No, but it's on my list. I just really like the lobster icon because I'm going to be in Paris in September, and I'm thinking that might be, you know, natural fibers and raffia. It might be my own self-brief for this trip. But I like to look at what I'm wearing, and then I'll pick a fragrance, or I'll pick an earring or something that's just a little bit off. Like something that doesn't match it, because that's just keeping myself really interested in the process. Because you don't want to get bored of dressing. It's a bit like food. You eat three times a day. How do you get re-excited about cooking? How do you get excited about dressing every day when it's just quite rudimentary? And for, you know, most of the world, it's a problem. It's not a privilege. Mm-hmm. So you sort of got to, I keep myself interested in what it is that makes me wanting to wear all my clothes. One, I feel like I bought you, I love you, I want to show you and get you out there. Two, I think it's so lovely. So when I see people who I think are so beautifully put together, I just say, I just have to tell you how glorious you look today. And when you tell that to somebody who truly did put in effort, you just get the biggest smile ever. When you say that to someone who's used to being a clothes horse or who can have every outfit at their disposal, it falls on deaf ears. So I like the reward system of when someone says it to me and then I can say it to them.
The final quote, which I guess plays into that idea of what you were saying about respecting the friends. You talk about your clothes like they're friends, which I like. But the final quote is often overused in sustainable fashion circles, but for very good reason. It is Her Royal Highness Vivienne Westwood. Mm-hmm. And it is buy less, choose well, make it last.
Yeah, I would say buy less, choose well, make it last, and buy whatever the hell you want.
That's you not know, what she like, means.
I know, but what I'm saying is that we buy clothes, we buy homewares, we buy things, and sometimes we don't need clothes. We need a hug, or we need to have a drink with a friend. But if we can think about why it is we're buying them and what it is it's doing to us, not just financially or psychologically or how it makes us feel for that short amount of time, we will more understand our drivers to it. And if you could stop everyone when they're making unethical fashion choices or fashion choices that you know are very cheap thrills and say, what is it that you're really here for?
What is it you really want?
What is it you really want? Well, I want to feel
better about myself
or I'm trying to hide under this jumper. I'm trying to say, look at my earrings, not at me, you know, or whatever it is that you're trying to say.
Or I'm angry and I want a distraction. Exactly. Or I'm feeling pressure by looking at other people who seem to have more than I have, which is such a weird impulse that I know is pushed through social media. You know,
well, it's also how the whole industry works. Homewares, fashion, that get it now, this will make your life better. Have you ever been to the house of somebody who's got their dream house and they sit there and going, I'm just not quite sure why it doesn't work. I'll need to buy more Diptyque candles, or I need to get the feng shui man in. It's like, no, problems follow whether they're dealt with at a shopping floor in a retail level, whether it's given to your architect. You know, it's really, those choices we make are so important and so telling. And so if you can think about the times that you've made poor fashion choices, and if you could match those up with what was going on in your life, there'd probably be a really good scene that you could go, ah, that's what happens. That's why I do that. No more. Or, you know what? Now I know it. I'm going to work around it. Or I will go get a hug, or I'll go get a cup of tea, or I'll go meet a friend, or I'll go read a book.
So when you say buy whatever it is you want, do you mean less buy on a whim whatever little t-shirt grabs your eye, and more invest
in... Just stop yourself and say, do I really need it? You know, is this going to fit with my vision for myself for the year? Is this, you know, I love dressing because I'm a freelance stylist who doesn't have an office to go to. So I get myself excited about going between my house and my suppliers and my office. And I just think I love it when I see somebody really beautifully dressed.
When you work from home, people often say to you, oh, do you work in your pajamas? Like, of course not. No. I couldn't actually concentrate unless I left the house in some clothes and then came back and felt like I was actually in a work brain.
When I first started working for myself and I had three small children at home, I really couldn't handle much. And I made a friend who was a scientist. And she was like, I don't really get what you do. And I was like, lady, hello. And I said,
what, nor do you?
Well, yeah, I can feel our stresses. And we went to each other's house, as in I went to her house, she went to mine. No one cleaned up. We worked from there for 3 hours and we didn't even like leave out tea or a cake. We didn't expect anything else. And when I went to her house, I used to get dresses if I was going to my office in Park Street. And I just powered through work. Because one, I wasn't in my own house. I was down the road, so it was still easy to get to. And two, space. I wasn't in my pajamas, or not even my pajamas. I mean, I don't wear pajamas, so I'm just like, thank God there are clothes, because, I mean,
otherwise, what, naked?
Well, hello. Working naked is not safe, nor is it conducive to, you know,
not
good
thought. Not even in Australia?
No.
Not even in the
absolutely
summer?
Absolutely not.
There could be listeners who differ. Megan.
Yes.
I would describe you as an interiors stylist, a house whisperer, a seeker, a traveler, and a believer in the importance of beauty.
Absolutely.
How would you describe yourself?
I am all of those things, but the one driver for me is making the best out of what you have. And I think that's a real styling process. Most stylists do that. They're looking in corners. They're looking to find out how they can turn a trick on something. In 2017, a lot of people are stylists and a lot of people are slashies and a lot of people work in this freelance art space. And I read a fantastic book by an author called Elaine Scarry. And Elaine is the professor of aesthetics and beauty at Harvard. And she's written a beautiful book on truth and beauty. And even though it's quite an academic book, I reread it 5 times with 5 different highlighters so I could make sure I was, you know, not cheat reading. And then I came back to her intro and she talks about basically that beauty wants to replicate itself. It always has, which is why when we look at Michelangelo, we love it. It's why when we look at Caravaggio, we just see something so ordinary but extraordinary, which is why when we see Ryan Gosling's face, we just go round and round and round. And I thought that is such a fabulous thing to hear and know, because in the world where everybody thinks, oh, she stole my Instagram picture, or that's my idea of a rock next door to a pebble with a feather, I'm like, no, we want to take these pictures, and we are screenshotting and having these huge sort of overindulged Pinterest folders just heaving with other people's work, not because we're trying to steal them, but because we actually love the beauty and we want to replicate it.
I love that
phrase. And we want
to
see it again and again and again.
Beauty wants to replicate itself.
Yeah, beauty wants to replicate itself. And when you think about that in terms of what we do when we see the Mona Lisa, what we do when we see any amazing art piece or any performance, we just can't believe it. So we want to put our phones up, even though we know it's uneducated and uncivilized and annoying to the other guests.
Or to catch it.
It's just why when we see something that's so lovely and tastes beautiful and the bouillabaisse is amazing, the souffle worked, we want to take a photo of it, even though we know... put our bottom in the air next to another diner is not it's not really good. But we can't, we want to hold on to that for 1 minute. And I think for me, that's what really is the justifiable way to think about Instagram and that constant need for new, new, new. Maybe it's the need for finding our own version of beautiful in a sea of over-delivered content. Because the cream rises to the top even on Instagram.
I wanted to jump forwards. I was going to ask you this later, but you mentioned the obsession with new, new, new. You and I have talked before about this idea of that kind of rapacious desire for more stuff. How does that apply to the interiors and the home decor? Decor is a weird word, isn't it?
I know, decor is such
home decor and renovations world, because I know how it works in fashion. But is there fast
Well, in your book,
interiors?
it made me so, I was, you know, photocopying that page that you and Leon Rossler spoke about, the, is it the rat syndrome? Not being hungry, and we call it factory outlet syndrome because factory outlet syndrome happens in the interior world a lot.
So it's the chase. They just want to run after the new thing, but they don't really want the actual thing when they get it.
But we're dealing with something that, you know, when we're dealing with houses, we're dealing with, let's take the physicality of a house, we're dealing with a building that will last for over 200 years. If it's an unsustainable, terrible building that is a new build and doesn't have any kind of sense of itself in terms of its ecological footprint, you're dealing with a mistake that not just you or the next generation will deal with, you're dealing with 200 years of potential mistake.
But that makes sense when we're talking about a building, but how about applying
that to
interiors?
Well,
then
you go inside and then you say, wow, everything in here is not the things I love. And then you could go to the Marie Kondo expression of, does it spark joy? And in a house, it's not just does it spark joy, it's can we fit it in here? Does it fit through our front door? Can we afford it without eating baked beans the rest of, you know, the year? Because every 6 weeks, there's got to be a new drop of something that makes us think, oh, my wooden chopping board's not great. I've always wanted the marble one from Hay. I'll just buy the Kmart one for $13. I have no problem with the fast deliverability of all of those things working backwards from a trend base, but there's only so many cake stands and breadboards people need in any one house.
So how do we then tap into this idea for having the most beautiful space we can afford to make and then balancing it with like not being rampant consumers who are just buying the nearest shiny thing just because it's there and cheap?
Because with houses, there is a stop button. There's only so many walls, there's only so many beds, there's only so many versions of velvet cushions or whatever it is that's happening that you need to own, because you don't want to have a second house to have your surplus. That is actually ridiculous, right? So there's a point where you have to say the house is done. You might not be done, but the house is done. When you look at Instagram and you look at things that are trending, or if you look in magazine pages, especially with the news pages with everything that is new and shiny and just recently dropped, you've then got to educate yourself around, well, what is it that I want to touch every day? I find it really obscene, or not obscene. I find it absurd that people don't think, I touch this breadboard every day. Would I not want it from a better material? Or I don't care about my breadboard, but I touch my bathtub because every day I have a bath. That's how I de-stress or whatever it is. I want to know the story of that tap. Why is
Are
it
those
that
stories
we...
being told? I mean, I
no,
guess that was
this
part
is
of
the
my...
whole point. This is why I'm shocked that this hasn't come into the interior world. Why is it that we know where our beef comes from? We know where our wine comes from, but we don't say, oh, this cup that I drink my coffee from every day, I don't care. It's just beautiful. It's just not enough anymore to be beautiful, right?
So these conversations are becoming more prevalent in the fashion industry. Are you saying that they haven't yet reached a point where they're very widespread in the interior
world? I would love to talk about them more, because I think that's where that's how a good house is built too. The storytelling of a house is not, I bought it all, added all to cart, or found it all in a magazine page. And, you know, it's just not how real houses are born.
Let's talk about vintage. I know that you love the stories behind that, and we've known each other for years and years, but we connected sounds so American. We connected
it's so
over
true,
vintage.
Though. Well, it was nonverbal. I saw you wearing such a beautiful outfit one day, and I wrote you a letter, and I just said, in
this
amongst all those fashion people, you just looked so gorgeous. What I love about vintage is when you find something and it's immaculate or near immaculate, you know that the care that someone took for you to find it in that condition, I've feel the energy around that is so wonderful. That someone loved it so much, they kept it buff, they waxed it, they cleaned it. There's just the right amount of wear for its age, and that's the stuff I really like.
Storytelling. You can imagine the owners.
And then you think, God, you have made it through the recession. You've made it through here. Let me look after you and put you in with something so Italian, modernist, sexy that you're just going to do my eyeballs a really great favor, or whatever it is that I'm like kind of planning it for. And that's why I love working with old and new. I think it's a real cliche, you know, for every new thing you have an old thing. But what I love is when you put them together in a really deliberate way and you just watch, you know, it's like you watch the sparks fly. It's incredible. Something that's got no history and that might be physically very beautiful or physically demanding or whatever the new piece is, up against something that's old, it's just like, oh, it's the best fire show in town. It's so wonderful, which is why I love, you know, anything that works in opposites, anything contrasty I'm really interested in. Old, new, rough, smooth, my God, black, white, future to the 30s, textured with shellac, you know. I love playing with the materiality of things, and the same with my clothes. I wear big voluminous dresses, but I'm actually, what I'm trying to do is start from a fabrication point. Is cashmere and silk the most edible combination for today's weather conditions? Oh my God, yes it is. I'm getting it all out. And I try and then I think, oh God, the colours don't work. Okay, hang on, moving backwards. But that's how I try and do houses, or that's how I try and merge things together that might have a history.
Where does all this come from in you? So I love the story that you grew up on a banana farm in Queensland. I mean, it sounds like something from a storybook. Is it real?
Yeah,
did you really?
I really did. Well, my family moved to Queensland when I was 8, and it was a formative time because I'd lived at my grandmother's house, our family house, and it was right near my studio, actually, in Kensington, and it was lovely and beautiful and very humble but very, very nice. And then we moved to this wild, wild banana farm because my parents had this idea that they wanted to grow bananas. I was like, why would you do that? That's not even
what did they do
part
before?
Of our family plan. My dad was a plumber and my mother was a teacher.
And so they just thought, let's move and be banana growers.
They actually blindfolded themselves one night and my dad twisted my mum around and she pointed and wherever her finger landed. And
Is that true?
Get
out.
Then my mother...
And it landed in Queensland.
It was always going to be Queensland because they wanted to have a horse and my father wanted us to grow up in the country. And then they were just really practical people who just thought, okay, well, we're going to have some land. What can we grow? What is the easiest thing to grow? My mother found the most incredible magazine called Grassroots. And it's really the kinfolk of today, but without the art direction. And it was how to do everything. So we had horses that my mother broke in from wild horses. We had crazy paving. My father built us a pool. He taught himself mosaic tiling, like very MacGyver-y type things. And I think it's really what a stylist does, knows a little bit over many categories. And that's really what a hobby farm is, trying a few things until something sticks. And then we were successful with bananas because our area were banana farmers. And it's where the Golden Door Health Retreat is it's now called Gold Coast Interland, but that area is really ripe for bananas. But it
what
was
are your
just,
memories of it?
Just heaven. It was heaven. It was just heaven. No shoes. My mum had some, she called them her city clothes. My mother had a lady come up from Colour Me Beautiful, and she gave my mother, who was a mad shopper.
Don't, because this is such an era-specific thing. I remember this too.
Do you remember
Mum,
the
if you're listening, I remember, and I'm not a summer person, whatever you say.
But what I loved about watching my mum get that, her confidence and her shopping stopped and she was really on target. And I watched her go from I'll buy everything because, you know, I'm in the country and yet I'm a city thinking person and I'm an academic and I'm smart and I'm independent, but hang on. And she just would say, oh, sorry, I just can't wear that.
What, because my colours are
right
only...
Like, yeah. And I looked at her and I thought, wow, that was, you could really like, my mum was really pre-Colour Me Beautiful and post, and she really got a really big backbone after that. And I was like, wow, power to you. Once you've got a brief on how you want to dress, the rest really is just shopping, isn't it? If you like shopping, that's an enjoyable thing. If you don't like shopping, that can be chore. Enter the internet, make things easy. But the grey bit is then where you identify. I mean, I love shopping because I love the theatre of shopping. I love to go to the city on the bus and go to the shops and just look at what everybody's doing. I love to look at the fixtures on the Prada window. I love to look at every little detail. I just walking here past the Miu Miu store, they have dulled brass with, it's like the breath of a marshmallow. This incredible pink that's not millennium pink, that's not a pink Pantone pink. It's a boucle carpet with then a shellacked version of the same pink. It's just like heaven. I'm not even looking at the clothes. I'm in raptures.
But you're looking at the design and you're seeing inspiration everywhere you look rather than saying, I must go buy this new handbag.
Absolutely.
But what would we do if we didn't have the shops? Recently, I've been worrying about the shops.
I'm really worried about the shops.
I campaign for less ridiculous shopping. I campaign actively telling people, don't buy stuff you don't need. Let's pull back this crazy consumerist culture we have. But the flip side of that is I worry about the shops. I don't want to live in a city that has only boarded up high streets and police signs everywhere. What? How do we balance that?
In the fashion world, absolutely.
But do you remember when you were a kid? Like my grandmother used to take me and my mother as well to, you know, up to the shops, and you'd go, as you're saying, and just look at the shelves and look at the jumpers and have a tea or something and go home. You didn't necessarily buy anything, but you treated it like a social thing and like a museum.
Well, it's the fabric of society. It really is. Shopkeeping, you know, my grandmother met my granddad at their fruit shop. The whole idea of being in a shop where people can come in and talk and chat and download and pick up whatever they need. I mean, it's a really important thing, which is why the vacuousness of a internet purchase will never give you the fullness of buying it from someone you know handpicked that for you.
It's interesting. I think it's partly to do with the way that we've removed the soul from a lot of our shopping. So when you say that your grandparents met in a fruit shop, I worry about the future of those kinds of shops on the high street too. Like where is the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, you know? What we have now is shiny edifices of very, very similar shop fronts churning out the same stuff that feels disconnected from how it was made.
Absolutely. You just have to put your money where your mouth is. It's really as simple as that, because it begins, that's why every day you get the chance to start afresh with all of this. You get to say, I choose to support the store that I know loves me and loves my what I'm into. You've got to find your shops and you've got to love them. I mean, I get really sad when interior stores close down, because for someone to have an interior store and really love their stuff, they're not just giving you their leftovers. They're saying, I've sourced the world for stuff. I really hope you like it. We need to value the idea that someone in your area has put their hand up to be a specialist in that area and say, I love Swedish furniture so much so that I want to make it easy for everybody here to have a little piece of that lovely that loveliness, or whatever it is that they're offering.
I want to talk about something completely different, which is busy women syndrome.
Yes. Okay, so my lovely client recently gave me a book called Rushing Women Syndrome.
Rushing Women Syndrome. You told me this the other day, and all I computed was you covered the book in brown paper.
Yes, so, well, it's such a sort of, you know, it's a challenging book cover to keep on your bookshelf, because I think it's got a cartoon, and I just think Rushing Women Syndrome is such a horrible name for a book. But obviously anyone who thinks it's horrible really does need it. And to me, I'm reading this book and I'm thinking to myself, I need to buy this for you. I need to buy this for everybody I know. But I did cover it in brown paper because it offended my eyes. There's no doubt about it. Doesn't mean I can't understand and appreciate the book, but I did cover it in brown paper.
What's it all about?
There's so much. It's about women's health over, you know, over the age really of, you know, 30. And when you are working, no matter what job you're doing, inside the house or outside the house, the kind of stress and the kind of health threats that are there. My one big takeout was this whole idea of fight or flight, which is very much, I think, what a lot of people are working under at the moment, no matter what business they're in. Everyone wants everything faster and cheaper. And people say to me, we really want you, but can you do it faster and cheaper? And I said, but I'm not fast, I'm not cheap. They said, but you have to. And I said, I actually can't, because my processes are not from when you hire me on the day. My processes start the minute you say, I've got this product and I need to make it look like this. And I will stew on it like a bouillabaisse. I will just slow cook it until it's so tasty and juicy. And I know it won't look like anything else in its category because I've loved it for that long. So the minute the shoot comes, it's not, you know, that's what they pay me for, but it's really that slow process. What's really helped me with this book is this idea of fight or flight, which is, okay, we want things faster, cheaper, now. We want it to look better. We want it to move this X amount of units or whatever it is the accountabilities are, versus the idea of resting and digesting. So fight and flight with rest and digest. And a lot of the times I used to think, oh, I'm going to Milan Furniture Fair for my rest. That's not a rest. Or, oh, I'm going to go to whatever it is, but I'll do a little bit of work there. I'll write part of my book or I'll do something there. It's not a rest. Proper, proper resting, as in totally tuning out. So I've invented this thing. Well, I don't know if I've invented it, but it came to me as I was being mindful with my meditation. Wouldn't it be fantastic to be mindless? Like, so this idea of mindlessness versus mindfulness. So it's not a bad sister to mindfulness. It's just a complementary tool that you can use. And it basically is all the things that made you super, super juicy happy when you were younger or when you were in your, you know, really carefree time. They're usually the same things that really get you excited now, but they just look different because the cost to entry might be different or geographically, you know, they might be different. But all the things I really loved when I was younger are the things now I use as my down tools thing. So for me, it's music and live performance and theater or anything where someone's standing on a stage, because I love the vulnerability of that kind of performance. I love certain smells. So I will go to, we have a community garden. My family has a plot of community garden. And I'll go there and just really kind of sit and cut the lemons and pretend I'm using them for styling. But I'm really just like, I love the smell of citrus. I love cardamom and orange and all those kind of things. I'm trying to surround myself with things that are really analog. So anything you can't get on the internet, because my whole world is basically a big Pinterest lie or a Pinterest facade. I'm trying to get my hands and my eyes and my ears and my nose into things that are not available on the internet. Smells, you can't smell on the internet. Tick. You can't really see performance on the internet. If you've ever gone, oh, I missed out on tickets for whatever, whatever, and then you've seen it, no, it's just not it. You want to see something
that goes
through you. Because
it's also the communal element.
Well, it's the energy of people who also appreciate it. And it's when someone does something so wonderful and you all saw it and you know no matter where you are in the world, you'll never see that again. And then I love the idea of sounds, you know, proper sounds or proper color. Color off the computer is heaven. That's why I go to old bookshops. Not because I do love old books, but I love to show people the colours that their houses should be based on old book cloth. You know, that proper book cloth burgundy or that proper hunter green are the most heavenly colours. Ivory, all that stuff that's not on the internet.
You show people some of this world of wonder through the school. I wonder if you'd like to just share with us a little bit about what the school does and some of the people that you've had to take classes there.
Yeah, with the school, we wanted it to be a place where you could come and really highly absorb something. So we distill classes that you could do over a weekend into 6 hours, 3 hours, or 1.5 hours. We're quite strict with the timing because as a working woman, I know that there's only so much you can do and so much you can get out of the house. We then take people overseas to India, Paris, and next year other places only for 5 days because we know that any more than that is unrealistic. So at the school, what we're trying to do is to get the best in the field to teach you something that is highly transferable, give you everything you might need to do it yourself, and hopefully plant a seed that when you sit down and touch something with your own hands and heart, it works in a really beautiful restorative way.
But it ain't maths homework, is it?
No.
I mean, what is it that you're teaching?
We are teaching Shibori. Even if you don't love blue, you will just have Shibori fever because it's heaven when you see the process of when oxygen hits this slumpy green and turns it into brilliant blue. It's just heaven on a silk scarf. We teach extreme knitting, which is just bonkers beautiful.
Extreme knitting is my favourite. Can you just tell us a little bit about Jackie Fink?
Jackie Fink, ex-lawyer, mother of three.
How do you knit extremely?
You have knitting needles that your father has fashioned from beautiful oak. They're 1.5 meters long, and it's like a knitting orchestra. We have to say in the pre-class notes, please don't wear a skirt because it's just hard to knit with needles that big. And you work with the most beautiful Australian merino wool that is literally, I mean, it's like touching a sheep.
And fat as a cat?
Fat as a cat. The wool lug itself is as fat as a cat. And you knit in ivory because it's the most natural colour. And we teach you how to knit We call it a wearable, but it's obviously then can be scaled up.
If you're a giant.
If you're a giant. Well, it's a scarf that you knit, but then you can go on to knit the blanket, or you can knit a pot, or you can knit a wall hanging, or whatever it is you want. But the minute people stop and realize that, look, women have been crafting and making since the beginning of time. Through every crisis, there has always been craft. If the community can craft, it can fix problems. Because if you look at third world countries, how they change their situation is through craft. Craft is the second biggest business in the world. So this, it's not just a thing that we do because we're bored, lazy women having downtime. It's a really important thing as human beings to actually sit and mark make and do something that says, yes, I was here. So when I see somebody with a little bit of embroidery with their name, of course I'm going to go without groceries and buy it. Of course I'm going to try my hardest to try and show people that this stuff is really important, not just historically, but because it was someone did put something of themselves in it.
How do you feel when you make something with your hands, and how do your students feel at the school when they've accomplished that?
I'm a great art dealer, but I'm a really bad crafter. My mum was a brilliant crafter. She did lots of everything, and I remember she even had market stalls where she'd make cutout magazine pictures and stick them on tiles and sew ribbons on them. Just like the worst decoupage ever. And her sisters would have the best time doing it. I took my own class. I took the Alana Wilson pottery hand building class. And the most gorgeous thing happened. I stayed back after the class to clean up and put the wine away. And I just sat there with the clay, and I made... I stayed there till like 12:30. I couldn't go home because I was so in the demi-moore moment, but I also was so in love with what I was making, and I couldn't leave it because the clock stopped. I was like, okay. I called home and said, I'm going to be home later. Pretend I'm out at a nightclub or I'm at a restaurant. And I kept going, and I went to bed with the sweetest dreams about, this is amazing. I'm going to be a potter. I now know what my third career is. And I was so high on what it was to have made that in the silence of my, you know, it wasn't like I was in a group. Anyone who's making something knows that you kind of need a bit of quiet down. It's not a high volume. The school looks high volume, but it's actually quite quiet. I went back the next morning and I was like, oh, Pat, where's my pots? He's like, there they are. I'm like, no, they're not my pots. They're far too unattractive. And they'd look like a cavewoman made them. Where's my pots?
That's such a good story.
I've got to
take
them to the firing. I was so in love with that idea. And I think that's what making for me is. It's not about the outcome or having it look like Joe Fowles' amazing or Rachel Castle's screen print. It's about how it makes you feel at that time. And when you make something, you really are in control. You're not, because the clay will then do whatever it wants to do, or the screen print will do that, or the shibori will oxidize in the way that you've forgotten that there was a little piece in there that might muck up your lovely pattern. But for that moment in time, you're actually creating something. And when you know you can do that, you know you can do anything. Because if you can do that as an accident and make a little pot, I mean, I have to show my pot. I mean, my God, it's
We
hilarious.
Will share in the show notes a picture of Megan's pot.
Well, there was actually two, because I thought, I'm so good at this. Just let me add another one. I was like, let me add it.
We began this with quotes from big name designers from fashion's iconic past. But I would like to end it with quotes from you. That'd be better, wouldn't it? I'm going to fire these questions at
okay,
you.
Okay, let's go.
What's your fashion rule to live by?
Find a texture. Because people who aren't fashion people will go, well, it's brands or it's colour or it's style. I'm like, no. Find the fabric. If you are really into easy care, hose it down, like vintage Gaultier is heaven. I don't know if you've noticed my skirt, but you can literally, I wear this on the aeroplane and it's vintage Gaultier.
It's Sunray Pleats.
From the Real Sunray Pleats. I can be in my economy seat and wake up in Paris, change
Spill
into
your
a
wine.
Blazer. Hello.
Fine.
I'm here. I love cashmere and knits because, you know, I'm trying to educate myself.
But not supermarket cashmere. No, thank you.
No, thank you. Find a fabric and let that be your guide, because then you can shop many brands and then you're not so worried about what is fashionable. Because I just feel like what is wearable? Because to me it's about wearability. How many times can I wear this? Will I feel good in it? Does it work with what I'm doing kind of this year? Do I put it just in my storage for a minute, or do I loan it to a friend? I've got like a vintage library. I sort my clothes with friends because I want them to be loved and worn.
The vintage library. What's your best thrifty tip? Is that it?
My best thrifty tip is okay, I sometimes feel the thrift. Like I wake up and I feel thrift. I'm like, today's the thrift day. Get me some. And so I will, like, I want to invent an app where you can plug in where you have to go for the day and it shows you how many thrift shops or thrift opportunities you've got. Thrift ops on the way. I know, right?
Do it.
I will one day.
If there are angel investors listening in, we would both like to do this.
Let's do the thrift op.
Do you like how I tried to steal your idea?
Yeah, no,
because
I like
under
it.
Each idea, there's another one. Give them away.
But this is why I'm saying someone invent it so then I can use it. Because today I didn't feel thrifty, but I don't know. You can't plan these things. Sometimes I just know. And when I work on what I know, I will just find the best things ever.
I really like how your definition of feeling thrifty involves going to a shop.
Well, it's going to an op. It's going to an op shop.
Because I love you. Because I love you. Because I love you.
Thank you for listening to Wardrobe Crisis. To learn more about our guests and the issues that we've spoken about today, hop on over to my website, which is clairepress.com/podcast. You can get in touch there, and I really hope you will. I'd love to hear from you. And you can also find links to my social media. And finally, if you're enjoying the show, please head over to iTunes and subscribe. You know what they say, first in, best dressed. Subscribers are first to find out when there's a new episode, and it also helps other people discover Wardrobe Crisis, so I'd love your help with that, because the more people who switch on to ethical fashion, the better. Music is by Montaigne. She recorded this special acoustic version of Because I Love You, which is from her Glorious Heights album, especially for Wardrobe Crisis. How good is that? Thank you, Montaigne.
Because I love you. My parents feel that this is a waste of time. I tell you we're okay. I won't admit that I am blind. My friends all feel that I'm carrying us still. I tell them all that they are wrong. Because I love you. Because I love you. Because I love you. Because I love you. Because I love you.
Jackrabbit FM.
For your ears.
Who is that? Hi, Puck Pass.